Hello, my name is Jan C. Scruggs, and I'm the guy who started the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., and I was actually born in Washington, D.C., which turned out to be a fortuitous place to be for me to be born. I have a lot of interests in my life. One has always been, military issues, and I was in the military for 2 years. I got wounded pretty severely, but overall it wasn't bad. But I actually had volunteered for the draft, so that's how I ended up there. Somebody else has kind of ended up there too, and Joel Spangenberg. He is the executive director. What are you, the chairman or what?
The acting director of Selective Service.
Acting director of Collective Service. And he's got quite a resume, a graduate of the famous United States Naval Academy. And as I'm sitting here, I can see the dome of the beautiful church. It's really, really nice. And inside it, it's got murals on the walls, scenes from the Bible and people going off and on and off ships. So let me just tell you, the average person I talk to, if I say, hey, I'm involved with Selective Service, he'll say, I don't think so. Nixon got rid of that back, 20, 35 years ago. And I remember I was at the University of Maryland, and then the story broke. They would no longer be in conscription in the United States. And I just said, well, that's a nice little political stunt, but if we really needed some extra people, you're not exactly going to be helping us. So anyway, what I'd like to do is ask Mr. Spangenberg, what is the basic job of your unit there, the Selective SSS?
Well, great. Thank you, Jan, for having me on your podcast. And I want to thank you for your many years of service to the country and your leadership on behalf of our nation's veterans. They certainly deserve our best. They gave their best, and we're all indebted to them for their service. I'll go back to your point here about Selective Service and just kind of give your listeners an update about what things look like now for us as an agency. Sometimes I get questions too in the community about who we are and what we do. But first off, it's important to understand who we are. So we are an independent federal agency. So we're completely separate from the Department of Defense, or an independent agency. And we've been a distinguished part of America's history, spanning both eras of peace and also conflict. Right now, our agency has a budget of over $31 million. We have up to approximately 120 full-time staff, 56 part-time state directors, up to 175 military reservists. We have contractors who support us. And also, this is, I think, a really unique thing for your listeners to hear. We have over 8,000 volunteers nationwide. So you can see we have a pretty diverse kind of personnel profile with which we work to achieve our mission. We also have a presence in different parts of the country. Our national headquarters is in Arlington, Virginia. We have our data management center, which is really our customer service center. That's in North Chicago, along with an operational site there. And we have two other sites, one in Marietta, Georgia, and one in Aurora, Colorado. Ultimately, the why, why we are here. We represent an additional tier of support to our nation's all-volunteer military. Our central mission is to manage the nation's conscription capability, and along with that, a program that would support conscientious objectors if we ever had to return to conscription. So right now in peacetime, we are operating in what we call an active standby status, with registration for young men across America being our most visible mission in peacetime. And you know, you're reflecting earlier in your comments too about the early 70s and some of the changes that took place then with the end of the draft. And you know, there hasn't been a draft in more than 50 years. And yeah, we do continue to register men ages 18 through 25 with selective service. And you know, we certainly do not hope for a return to conscription. Certainly, I think that would portend certain things happening. But you never know what the future may hold. Ultimately, our mission is to maintain a state of readiness if the president and Congress reinstated a draft in response to a large-scale national emergency. So that's really kind of why we're here and who we are and what we do now. And you know, and I guess kind of get to the essence too, if you know, for some listeners who are wondering, hey, you know, we haven't used this capability in a long time. Does it need to stick around? And I actually would say there are some strong words out there about this too. And ultimately, as a product of the all-volunteer force myself, you know, we've been very fortunate as a country to have an excellent all-volunteer force that's really served the nation quite well since the Vietnam War era. But as you know, just because we have that sort of a force that's excellent and can meet those kinds of conflicts we have now, this certainly does not mean that a larger conflict against a peer or near peer adversary will not occur. So you can see that tying back to what I was saying about readiness and making sure we're in the right headspace and we're thinking about the kind of the paradigm of conflict. And I think that did inspire a bipartisan group recently. So in the final report of the Bipartisan National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service, and this was a group that was championed by the late Senator John McCain and other senators, I believe, even Senator Reid. I think this was a great effort. But they issued a report in March 2020, which, as you know, was a tough time to issue reports because everything in the world seemed to be shutting down COVID pandemic. But I certainly wouldn't want to take anything away from the effort. I think that timing just wasn't great, but it doesn't mean the content itself wasn't. I think the content in there was really first class. And the commission itself takes a similar position that the nation needs the selective service to support the all-volunteer force to ensure our military can meet its personnel needs in the face of future threats and to demonstrate our nation's resolve to international allies and to our adversaries. And you know, to build on this, the Department of Defense has seen the importance of selective service too. You know, for example, if we look back at 2023, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Hicks, from DoD, she actually, you know, she really brought it front and center that we do provide an additional tier of support to the all-volunteer force and alluded to the fact that, you know, if there is a major conflict, we would need to be there to help DoD support its needs. So it's interesting that we've had those inputs from that National Commission and we've heard that from DoD. And if you kind of look at this a little bit more too, you know, during a major conflict, time could be a critical factor. It's important to have a capable system like ours in place, and I would argue, including ongoing registration, so that we are ready to increase the size of the military to meet strategic needs. And to us, it's really clear why presidents, Congress, and DoD have remained resolute in their support of the agency and its role. And I'd like to add, we've enjoyed the support of administrations since the agency's formal establishment as an independent agency in 1940, ahead of US entry into World War II, I might add. And this was built on the initial formation of the concept of selective service in 1917 during World War I as part of the Department of War.
You know, people are, there's not this continuity as a nation. We're very divided. And we've always been divided. Remember the Civil War? Gettysburg, all that sort of thing. So some people are very upset about these migrants who are slipping across the border. And so what happens when you get somebody like that? What do you do?
So I think that really gets to the heart of what does this mean to registration as well? What does this mean to Selective Service? And I just want to start with the point that virtually all men 18 to 25 years of age, American men, need to register with Selective Service. That also includes immigrant men and dual nationals, including undocumented immigrants who do come into the country. So it's very important that they get registered. And that's something that we're aware of, that we have worked with different groups to help raise awareness. So that's something that we actively work on. But it's important that right now, so for instance, immigrants register, because there is a penalty if they don't. They could be delayed in obtaining citizenship. So we share that information with different groups that connect with diverse communities. So they know the importance of this civic duty, and that they know also that there are penalties for not registering as expected, whether they're in a legal status or in a non-legal status. It's ultimately something we want to work towards, which is compliance with the law, because it's a very important civic responsibility.
What about women? I mean, I got to ask that question. A lot of people are probably wondering, my daughter going to get drafted?
That is one of the top topics we do hear about at Selective Service System. So one of the things I would want to point out is that should Congress and the President pass a law that requires females to register, we can implement such a change. So that's within the realm of the possible. So right now we have a legislative proposal for automatic registration that we shared with Congress that would require automatic registration for men at this point, ages 18 through 25 years of age. So I just want to share that if we're told to, we could do it. Ultimately, it's not our decision as an agency. Now, what I'd like to actually highlight is my own opinion on this as well, as somebody who's been a member of the all-volunteer force and served alongside outstanding service members, both men and women. And I think it's in having the perspective of having served in the agency at two different occasions, along with that, I think that's kind of helped shape my views over time. So I was the chief of staff at Selective Service from 2012 to 2015. But I think the expansion of the registration requirement to all genders would ensure that the nation would be in the best position to increase the size of the military rapidly and thoughtfully if it needed to do so. DoD would have the benefit of having a larger and more diverse set of skills available to it should there ever be a return to conscription during a major conflict. Since we can't truly predict the future and know exactly what capabilities will be needed most during that emergency, the people could be needed to fill a wide variety of roles, such as in IT, in cyber operations. It could be drone operations, logistics, also as mechanics or in HR and administration and civil affairs. Certainly, there's kind of this model that when I talked about paradigms, I have to go back to that World War II era. What did the country need then to deal with such a kind of an existential threat where all of society had to contribute? And it's important to keep that in mind, because I do think that there was a very wide variety of roles and a huge variety of non-combat roles that were critical for the nation succeeding overall and having the strategic capabilities in multiple places at multiple times. So, and I also want to kind of make a finer point, because I get the sense there's sometimes some confusion about registration and conscription. It's important to really distinguish the difference between those two things. Registration and induction for military service through a draft are two separate legal authorities. So, for example, registration can be expanded, but that doesn't mean anyone will be inducted, like being brought into the military. We could have an all-volunteer military with an expanded registrant pool. So that's possible. So like I said, if that law changed, we can help implement that. Induction, which would be the key act of a draft and is different than registration, can only happen if a different part of the law specifically changed to allow it. A law for induction can be shaped by considerations at that time, which, for example, could consider the scope and type of the national emergency facing the nation. And lawmakers and the president, of course, would have a key hand in shaping that, what that induction would look like. And you can imagine this would be on the front page of every newspaper in the world and all over the internet is probably this big moment and really a challenging moment in the country's history. But you know, I do want to make that point that these are separate authorities. And just because you expand registration doesn't mean that induction is definitely defined forever after that. So I think that's something I'd like to share. And I also want to make the broader point to everybody that I want to emphasize that we haven't had a draft in a long time, and there's no indication that there will be one. I think it's important, though, to have some clarity about these items because I do know that they come up from time to time and people will talk about them, debate them. But I think having a little more clarity about them and also hearing from me, and I've worked in this agency for a while, and I've actually kind of learned as I've gone along, I think it's important for people to hear my views because they may help them kind of reconsider their positions on things. Thank you.
Is it true that if they reactivated the draft, that you could go to Beverly Hills and see three or four psychiatrists and say, "Congratulations, you're in the army now"? Is it true there is a no exemption for people trained in medicine?
It's I wouldn't want to get out of all ahead of all the deferments, postponements, and exemptions, but there very well may be some very critical exemptions, and you know we may have people in the public health service who, because they're part of the uniform health service, that may have specific roles to help the country. It's hard to say exactly what it is, but you know I think a key change, kind of which I think we're kind of poking out here, is that selective service. You know we hear a lot. You know we have these local boards nationwide. Those local boards are not there to actually select people. And I think people sometimes have this historical model, like these draft boards are choosing all the people from their community to send. And that's not how that is now. And they're also the draft, you know, like the concept of the draft board, I think maybe historically they had more of a role in helping to evaluate people for military service and maybe the involvement of doctors. We certainly don't have that responsibility, that evaluation responsibility rests with the Department of Defense. And our local boards, actually, I think this is a twist on things from, you know, from I think further back in our history. These local boards now are there to hear claims. They're there to hear claims for exemption, like from conscientious objectors. And I think having them helps bring that impartiality as much as possible in those local communities to hearing these claims and helping to process them in a timely manner by the local community. So it's a different way to do it. But I would emphasize that DoD handles the military side of how people would be evaluated for service.
Yeah. Well, I spent a year of my life in Vietnam. That was like jungle warfare, you know, small arms, AK-47s, a couple old machine guns. That's what they had. We had B-52s and everything you can imagine, but we did not have what we needed. So, but on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, we tell people there are 17,000 draftees, but in fact, they're probably more like 18,500 because they had a different way you could go in the military. You could volunteer for the draft, or you could go to a recruiter for your 2 years. And in my high school, you know, a couple guys volunteered. Most guys said, "Look, I have to do it, I'll do it." And that's what they did. They just became guys who lived in little suburban houses, and next thing you know, they were in Vietnam. But we hope for the best. I really hope for a society which can wean itself of this anger and vitriol, so we can pull together and make it an even better country. What do you think of the United States?
Well, I love the nation, and I truly believe that we have something special that we need to care for in this country, and I just show a lot of gratitude for those who founded the country and have worked to continue to make it better and better over time. And I think that's an important role of citizens and being engaged in our democracy, caring and serving and making things better together and working with people who might not share all the same views. And I reflect even back on my service in the military, how wonderful it was to have a chance to work and serve alongside people from much different backgrounds on a shared item of importance for the country. And I came in to the Navy shortly before 9/11 and continued to serve after that point. And just seeing the team of people that will work together to help support national defense was always inspiring to me. And what I would say is, kind of picking up on that thread about service, I think that there's a lot of opportunity for us to continue to do more to encourage service, because what we have is special in this country. And I want to kind of build on something here and kind of build a little bit of a model for you. So over the past 23 years or so, approximately, with the Department of Defense, we've had an agreement with them to help them with recruiting for the all-volunteer military. What that looks like is this. We have our registration acknowledgement letters that we send out to young men who are registered. In those letters, we include military service and recruitment materials. So when that young man has an opportunity, when they open that letter and they see the registration acknowledgement card, they'll also have that opportunity to think about serving. It gives them that moment. And I know sometimes people's parents will open the mail. They may also tell their son about service opportunities. So that's been something that the Department of Defense has valued. It's helped them. And I think that this has been a very key thing for us. And, if I go back to this report I mentioned, the bipartisan report, and how we are already kind of, thinking about things and helping DOD with their all-volunteer military, that 2020 report from the National Commission also signaled the need for expanded collaboration between federal agencies to boost public awareness about service opportunities. And I think that's exciting to me. So in line with that National Commission report, we have recently begun partnering with AmeriCorps. And this year we signed an agreement with them to help them enhance awareness of their national service opportunities among young men. And we are looking to do something similar with the Peace Corps in the future. And we are also interested in piloting some opportunities like this in support of public service. So we're exploring that as well. And if we zoom out a little bit, what we've developed is a vision that selective service could be a hub for service across military, national, and public service, building on our unique capabilities to engage with young men and potentially more, if the law were to change to expand it, who are on the verge of choosing their paths in life. So we believe young people who serve our nation will develop a better understanding of how government works and have a greater sense of responsibility in shaping the nation's future. They will also gain that service ethos that will help ensure the vitality of America for generations to come. And, when they have children, those children will hear about service from them. And if you actually look at the numbers of young people right now, and I don't have the statistics handy, but I'm somewhat familiar with it, but I believe that younger population that might be in that realm of potentially serving the military. So I'll roughly say that 17 to 26-year-old population. My understanding is 77% of them would meet their military's requirements to serve. So that means 23% are available to serve the military and 77% aren't, and that's under current conditions. But I wonder, what can we do? I mean, the 77%, we certainly want to encourage them to serve as well. So I think that's a great thing to do. If we can encourage all young Americans to serve in a way that will help the country, that's wonderful. And some in that 23%, let's say they go into military service, or some don't. Well, maybe they don't. Maybe they start in the Peace Corps and then they find out they love service and they end up in the National Guard. So there could be multiple paths to service. And then people may start their career in the military and they might end up in the federal government serving. But these are all good things that I think we could really take a strategic perspective on it and really kind of take this integrated approach across government to increase service awareness. So I think this is a really game-changing opportunity for us in this country to help us with maintaining how great our democracy is and that we need to continue to have citizens invest their life in service and make things stronger. And on June 21st of this year, Selective Service System, along with the Department of Defense, Peace Corps, OPM, we are getting together for a Service for America Summit to talk about these things, about how we can integrate service, how we can raise awareness to young people who may not hear about these opportunities in high school. I cannot tell you the exact status of civics education, but hey, what can we do at Selective Service to help the country, to help colleagues, to say, hey, we can let you know about service opportunities. Why not try to do something new and different using some of these great capabilities we have? So we're thrilled about these opportunities. We see this as another way where we can help the country.
Well, keep up the good work. We're completely in support of your leadership, and we're lucky to have you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Jan. I really appreciate that.